This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to The View from 22 podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, the assistant editor of The Spectator. In this week's issue, Melanie Phillips writes on the issue of gender. She argues that not all children are gender fluid and that it can be dangerous to try and persuade them otherwise. Melanie is joined by trans activist and civil servant Jackie Gavin. And is the game over for sport? Simon Barnes says that with scandals embroiling tennis, athletics and football, amongst others, the sporting world is in trouble as never before. He says there is a danger that spectators are losing trust, beginning to walk away, and the Spectator's Alex Massey agrees. I'll also be talking to the Spectator's political editor, James Forsyth, who says more politicians across Europe are realising the European project is in grave danger, whether Brexit happens or not. We'll be joined by Spectator editor Fraser Nelson. Now, is it bigotry to believe the sexes are binary? Are there only boys and girls, or is everyone something in between? Melanie Phillips fears that it is fast becoming politically incorrect to maintain the distinction between the sexes, and the chair of the Women and Equalities Committee, Maria Miller, has said government should strip back ways of bringing up gender. But Melanie says it isn't gender which is fluid, just the language we use to talk about it. She's joined by leading trans activist Jackie Gavin, vice chair of Agender, the civil service network for gender identity. So Melanie, in this week's magazine, you say that promoting gender fluidity is likely to make children confused or distressed. Why is that? Is that not just actually just being kinder to children and letting them feel a little bit more free in their identities?
I think there is a tremendous confusion over all of this. And I took issue in particular with the committee, the Select Committee on Women and Equalities, which basically says that you don't even have to have gender reassignment to say that you are a different sex from the one you were born into, that it's good enough just to say that you are that sex. And this is this notion of gender fluidity, which I take great issue with, because gender is not fluid. Gender, as I say in the piece, is formed from the complex interaction between biology and environment, nature and nurture. You can't really separate them out very easily. Now, obviously, there are some individuals who have a problem in that they don't feel that the sex into which they are born corresponds with the gender that they feel themselves to be. And I have every sympathy with this plight. It must be an appalling plight. But it really won't do to agree with what is basically a disordered point of view, that what I feel myself to be at any one time, I feel myself to be a man, I feel myself to be a woman, I feel myself to be of no sex or gender, that should be taken to be the reality. And as a result, I think the committee is at risk of doing two things. First of all, being actually unkind to transgendered people by dismissing what I believe to be the very real problems that they have, and by assuming that gender reassignment can solve those problems where all the evidence is that very often it doesn't, it's actually quite cruel to transgender people. And the second thing is that by asserting that everyone's gender is fluid, this is basically untrue. But it goes beyond that, because we are being told that to question gender fluidity in its various manifestations is a form of bigotry. And consequently, this is an attempt to kind of coerce society in general into adopting a position which is fundamentally untrue, and which I think can indeed increase confusion among children, for whom very often they want to pretend to be the other sex, and it can actually, I think, inspire them to think that maybe they aren't really a boy or a girl at all, whereas in fact that isn't true.
Jackie, do you think that the Commons Select Committee has been unkind to children and to transgender people as well?
First of all, I'd like to say thank you to Melanie for her very, very kind comments there. I think she is spot on about the actual aspect, about the aspect of the transgender individual. Who, I mean, as somebody who went through this process, I had to go on a journey from A to Z, which is what I'm assuming what Melanie is alluding to, and I think that is absolutely spot on. I think the aspect about the children, I mean, I think we're seeing more of an increase these days of individuals, particularly children, who fall into this space of self-identifying or self-replicating about who they actually are and where they believe they are. And that's, I think, where the actual fluidity comes into. And I think, I suppose what I'm trying to say is that the actual message that the Commons Committee is doing, it seems to have actually confused the issue, which is what I feel sometimes that the gender fluid does bring to the equation. Because suddenly some people feel that, well, where do I actually sit? And a lot of other people then who are in this space themselves and think, well, where are you actually sitting? Because kids themselves, when they grow up, we all did it. We all grew up in clothes of the opposite gender. But is it about actually promoting that aspect? I don't know if it is, actually. I think the actual committee itself has said what it said. It's given out its message and allowing the things. I mean, we've got things like sort of Marie Miller saying about the non-marker on passports and things like that. But where exactly does this actually fit? And where does this actually allow the person to identify? Because historically, we want to be identified. And that's
exactly
it sounds as though the committee has confused gender fluidity with gender dysphoria. And those are two separate issues that almost could be addressed by two separate inquiries rather than rolled into one report. Is that right, Jackie?
That's what I would certainly feel. I think it needs to be done as a separate issue. I mean, you've got the very, very issues that affect the individual who goes on, as I would call it, the journey to transition from one gender to the other gender. But then you've got the other people, as we've said, who will sit in that middle ground. And now they've got issues that are totally different to what I have faced throughout my life as a transgender individual.
And Melanie, does this also enforce quite stereotypical concepts of gender? If you think that you don't identify as a woman, is that simply because as a young girl, you might not have wanted to wear pink and do ballet and that sort of thing, as you say in your piece?
Well, you might say that it reinforces those stereotypes. I mean, when it comes to children, as Jackie says, lots of children dress up in the clothes of the opposite sex. And I'm sure that it's correct to say that I'll have no reason to doubt that more and more children are becoming confused. My issue with the committee is that their position will actually increase that confusion by telling children something that's actually wrong. And on the subject of children, before I leave the subject of children, I mean, Jackie says, you know, is there any evidence that this is being sort of encouraged in the wrong direction? Well, I quote in the piece some evidence from America, from a psychiatrist in America who was involved with the Johns Hopkins Medical Center and University. The Johns Hopkins Hospital pioneered gender reassignment surgery and then stopped doing it because they felt that it caused more problems than it solved. But he reports, the psychiatrist reports, that in America now, children are being increasingly treated by doctors with puberty-delaying hormones. These are children of whom he says some 80% will grow out of this desire to see how it feels to be dressing up as in the opposite sex and so on. But they're being treated with hormones or hormonal drugs, which in themselves are dangerous. They have side effects, lasting and permanent side effects. And this is not adequate or responsible medicine at all. The other point is that, as Jackie says, my understanding of transgender people is that far from Maria Miller, who chaired this Equalities Committee, she has gone on record now as saying that gender is irrelevant. That's why she wants to remove the gender box, as it were, from passports and official documents. Well, my understanding of transgender people is that far from being irrelevant, gender is all important. And if they have gone through the agonies of changing of attempting to change their sex through gender reassignment, it seems to me quite callous, in fact, to say, and quite illogical from Maria Miller's own point of view, to say that it's irrelevant and it doesn't matter what they call themselves, and because they're not going to have the chance to say that they are now a woman or a man anyway. I mean, the confusions in this whole discussion and debate seem to me to be almost inexhaustible.
Jackie, what do you make of that?
I mean, a couple of things. I would like to pick up on the point that Melanie refers to with the drugs regarding that actually hold back the actual development of the individuals. I think the reason why that actually happens is my understanding, particularly for somebody who goes through the process of, say, male to female or female to male, it holds back the process of puberty. And I know that there are individuals that go through that process and will actually take these drugs. I don't think there is any danger. I hear what Melanie is saying, but I don't think there is any real danger in the aspect, because what it does, it stops the onset of the development of, I don't know, breast tissue, for example, in a female to male aspect. It stops the actual development of the hair growth and also what would be seen to be the brow ridge in a male to female aspect. And what it does, I mean, there is evidence to back this up where it shows that the individual is more likely to be able to present, because one of the biggest issues that transgender people face, particularly from a male to female perspective, is the way they actually look. Now, the way they actually look can actually be affect an individual in a very, very big way. It shows that the individual themselves may not present as well in the gender that they're transitioning into. And this is where it causes a lot of issues. That's where a lot of the problems come, because then the finger pointing comes out, the people start pointing and saying, well, look, it's one of them, trannies or whatever it may be. And we don't deserve that. Nobody in that position deserves that. And that's why, as somebody who went through the process of transition, yes, at a relatively young age, I still had the process where I felt the way I felt from a very, very young age. I mean, I felt the way I felt from about the age of 7. That's what they reckon most people who go through this process start to develop the emotional attachment to, recognising that there's something not quite right with the way they actually fit. And that's when suddenly there's that sort of presentation. It's nothing to do with the actual dressing up. It's just that emotional attachment of not belonging to where you actually feel you're attached. And that's why I welcome what John Hopkins has done, because, as I say, I know it's stopped, but as I say, I welcome that opportunity for that to actually happen, because it allows the individual to be able to take time. If they decide that they don't want to progress, because, I mean, we know that people will not always go through the full process, then they can then come off those blockers. And then they will develop naturally. There is evidence which has actually backed this up. I can't remember exactly where it's come from, if you bear with me. But as I say, I know there is evidence where some people have done that. So that's the first point I would actually state.
Okay. And just finally, very quickly, Jackie, Maria Miller, in her response to the publication of her Select Committee's report, has talked a lot about feminists being the only people who've been negative about this report. Do you think that there is a battle between feminists and transgender people, or is that something that Maria Miller is sort of creating herself?
There has been a bit of a battle. I mean, I notice in Melanie's piece about, we'll talk about Jermaine Greer in particular, and that has been very much a battle that has gone on. There is other people as well that has been brought into this equation as well. And I don't think it is just down to Marie Miller. I think there is a lot of issues where there has always historically been disagreement between feminists and transgender people for one reason or another. But as I say, no, from a personal point of view, I think it's a battle that will always remain in place.
That was Melanie Phillips and Jackie Gavin discussing gender. Next up, Simon Barnes argues that sport is in danger of eating itself up, and that fans are realising that many sportsmen and women are not to be trusted. He says sport is losing its innocence and meaning, and that with that, the public's faith in sport is dying. Alex Massey says sport is a quest for the sublime and the epic, and when it's reduced to mere entertainment, something is lost. So, Simon, it's been a very disappointing few months for sport. Do you think there's an end in sight to the scandals? Or actually, are we going to see more and more sports that people love and pay a lot of money to watch falling?
Yeah, the sports pages have become a sort of thing you read in two parts these days, haven't they? First, obviously, when you find out how Arsenal got on last night and whether England managed to do another collapse at cricket, and whether England, Britain have got any tennis players or not, and all that stuff we're used to. And then we've got stuff it's all to do with business deals and crooked deals and bribery and corruption and match fixing and doping and all that other kinds of stuff that we basically left the front pages to try and avoid. We really don't want real life creeping in onto the sports pages. That's not their function. But more and more and more, we've got this terrible real life happening on our sports pages in front of us. And it's not what we want sport for. It's not what sport is all about. Sport is becoming something in which people make a great deal of money from. And as a result, they will change sport in order to make increasing numbers of money, amounts of money from it. And that is almost always to sport's detriment.
And in your piece, you say, Simon, that the people will start to lose faith in sport. And I wondered, Alex, whether you're less inclined to buy tickets for cricket matches, for Wimbledon, over the next few years because of the revelations that we've had over the past few months and years.
Well, I think it is the case that it becomes harder and harder to suspend sufficient disbelief, if you like, that you're watching something that is sport as it is supposed to be. I mean, the point Simon makes is absolutely correct, that the people who run sport, and this doesn't matter whether it's athletics or tennis or cricket or football, really just about any sport, really, the people who run sports and so on increasingly see them as businesses, and not just businesses, but part of the entertainment industry. But sport isn't actually a part of the entertainment industry. If you want, it's about something much more visceral than mere entertainment. It's a quest for the epic, for the sublime. It's about feeling alive and part of something. And the more you exploit fans, although these days they're referred to as customers, the harder and harder it is for supporters and fans to remain enthused by what it is they're paying to see, because people realise when they're being exploited. And so sports administrators have no understanding of what it is that actually makes sport special. So, for instance, I mean, scarcity, for instance, is one of the things that makes sport special. Rarity matters, you know. So in cricket, to take one example, we've had England playing Australia almost every year in recent times and so on. And it's too much. You know, England versus Australia for the Ashes should be a special occasion. It should be something you've spent a long time looking forward to and getting yourself ready for. That's what makes it matter. That's why it's important. If you have it every year or every 18 months, you know, then you kill that. It becomes too familiar. But you make more money, of course, because you can always squeeze a bit more out of the long-suffering supporter. But in the end, you actually end up killing the thing that you're supposed to be loving.
And is this not a danger, Simon, that actually the quest to keep people entertained also not just corrupts but also exhausts the athletes involved, because you've got cricketers who are bouncing from game to game to game, really unable to recuperate from a test or prepare for the next one?
Absolutely. I mean, you are faced with two ways of running sport. First is to maximise income. The second is to maximise the pursuit of excellence and to put everything in that you possibly can to make sport as good as possible, not just as exciting as possible, but as a higher level of human achievement as it possibly can be. If you do so by trying to play 100 matches in a season while insisting you have your big name player out there, then your big name player is going to be less and less good at what he or she does. And you are basically losing the point of what you're doing. But what you're doing is making money. But what concerns me, not just that you're losing sport, but by following that, you will be gradually losing the interest of committed people who want to follow sport. And by seeking to attract the fringe audience, you are, in fact, slowly, inevitably betraying your heartland. You think the heartland, they're the people who put up with absolutely anything. We've always got them. We don't have to worry about them. So we can go out and try and dress the thing up with gimmicks like, you know, six hits as how many can you get, or penalty shootouts and things like that. And what is actually happening is that you are slowly throttling the life out of the sport that's at the very heart of it all.
So, Alex, what can be done about this? In other sectors, we might say that what the athletes need is a trade union. Do we need that in sport?
Well, I mean, of course, I mean, there are increasingly, you know, player associations that act as quasi-unions and that try and cut deals, if you like, with the administrators running sport to try and sort out the schedule, which is crazy in a lot of sports. I mean, tennis and golf and football and cricket are obvious examples of that, rugby too. But these are, in the end, insufficient in some ways. I'm not sure that, that unionising things is ever going to really work, because the commercial pressures are such, and there's so much money to be made now at all levels of the game, both for administrators and players, that you know, the temptation to just keep going the way it is almost irresistible. But it does leave you in the situation whereby, in the example, to take the example of tennis, for instance, you have a huge number of tournaments played each year that are, by and large, pretty fundamental sense, meaningless. There's the accumulation of some ranking points, which matters, but apart from that, there's no real point in these tournaments taking place. Now, so in that situation, and with the amount of money that is swirls through tennis in terms of, and the amount of money to be made from gambling, I'm not sure that it is all that surprising that players should be offered bribes to influence the result of a match one way or another, and that some players will actually take them, because, you know, the point of the sport actually isn't the quest for glory or the sublime anymore. It's just a simple question of making money, and that cheapens sport in the end. And in the end, money will kill sport.
Simon, what do you make of that?
I'm very much in accordance with it. It's not something that, you know, doom is about to happen tomorrow. It's that there is a growing tendency for the darker parts of sport to come to be destroyed at the expense of what really matters. We're losing the soul of it because sport is being run by people who have lost the sense of sport as a thing of joy, shared and individual joy. And it's in the hands of people who see that you can make really extraordinarily large sums of money from all this. And wouldn't it be better if we tweaked it even more by making something else, giving another commercial opportunity? So, for example, they've now got golf in Rio. This is a purely commercial decision because it was conceived that what a wonderful thing it would be to have Tiger Woods marching down the 18th fairway towards a gold medal right on prime time during the East Coast television. Of course, this thing has changed somewhat till then, but it's basically been brought into the Olympic Games because it's a vast commercial opportunity, not an appropriate Olympic sport whatsoever, because an Olympic sport, the Olympic medal has to be the highest achievement you can possibly get in that sport. And this is just a little consolation prize in golf, because it's the four major tournaments that matter in golf. So here is just a classic example of the way sport is happily and willingly selling its soul, and in fact it's being sold by people who wasn't even aware that sport did have a soul. All they see is the money.
That was Simon Barnes and Alex Massey on the problems in the world of sport. A reminder of our special subscription offer for listeners of The View from 22. For just £22, you can receive a 22-week subscription to The Spectator in the post, along with access to our website, iPad, iPhone and Android apps. Sign up to read all the articles discussed in this podcast at spectator.co.uk/22. Now, finally, The Spectator's political editor, James Forsyth, asks this week if Europe is sinking anyway, regardless of whether Britain votes to stay or leave. He says pessimism about the EU's future is rife across the continent and suggests that the will of politicians to keep the European dream alive might be waning. We're joined now by The Spectator's editor, Fraser Nelson. So, James, in your politics column this week, you say that some Conservative ministers are thinking about arguing to stay in Europe on the basis that it would save Europe. But your argument is that Europe is actually sinking anyway. But why is that?
I think we can't know that Europe is sinking anyway. What I think is interesting is that as Tory ministers, you know, they are like Robert E. Lee. offered command of a Union army, but feeling this great loyalty to the state of Virginia. And they're trying to work out how they square this dilemma between their personal loyalty to David Cameron and their principal commitment to leaving the European Union. And I think one of the arguments that has been hit upon rather conveniently is that you can vote to stay in on the grounds that Europe's going to collapse anyway. And do you want perfidious Albion to be the ones who pull the plug on the whole European project? And so I think what we're seeing is an attempt to rationalise doing the politically expedient thing and voting to stay in. But then you can't get around the fact that the European Union is in the greatest crisis of its existence. I got this completely wrong. I thought the Eurozone crisis would cause far more problems for Europe than it did. I was amazed the extent to which the electorates in Spain and Greece were prepared to accept massive austerity measures without actually wanting to leave either the Euro or the European Union. But the migration crisis seems to be different. It seems to be pulling Europe apart in a far more fundamental way than the Eurozone crisis ever did. And I think it tests to the limit what European solidarity means. You know, if you look at what Jean-Claude Juncker says, he wants every country in the European Union to essentially have a Mediterranean border. And what I think you're seeing is Northern European countries, Eastern European countries, the Baltic states saying, hang on a second, we don't actually want to have a Mediterranean border. And at the same time, you have Italy and Greece saying, well, we just can't survive if we don't have some kind of level of burden sharing here. And so I think that Europe is in the greatest crisis of its existence right now. And the one of the interesting things is that in Brussels, they now want a British referendum sooner rather than later, because they think it would be a triumph for them. It will be something that enables them to say, look, we've actually got a win here. We've kept the Brits in. And that what's so interesting is that this referendum that they hated for so long, they now see as some kind of firebreak on the kind of anti-European, anti-EU narrative of the moment.
So Fraser, do you think that may mean that David Cameron comes back from his renegotiation with a little bit more than we were expecting, or are you expecting it to be largely cosmetic, as everyone's been saying for quite a while?
Well, I keep being told by people in the government that David Cameron is optimistic about what he's going to come back from Brussels with, optimistic about his manifesto pledge to deny welfare to immigrants for 4 years, which is strange because I hear from other people in Europe that Cameron is nowhere with these things, so I'm not quite sure how he's going to pull this rabbit out of the hat, unless of course he intends to place lots of weight onto verbal formulas like, for example, we're not going to do any more ever closer union. So, you know, I wait, we've only got 2 or 3 more weeks to wait now until we see what he comes up with. But I think David Cameron believes that it doesn't really matter what he comes up with because the momentum is behind him. Now is a good time for him to have an election. The opposition is nowhere, the public aren't yet fed up with him. They might be if he waits too long. This isn't a midterm election, so, you know, and also the Leave campaign is in disarray. There are 2 Leave campaigns right now. They haven't got a leader. 3. Well, you know, it is right now. It was hoped, stroked feared, that somebody like Boris Johnson might have emerged right now as a figure to lead the Leave campaign to counteract David Cameron. That hasn't happened, so it seems like a good time to hold this vote. Now, right now, there will be pressure on Britain to take our fair share of immigrants. Under the current formula being proposed, our fair share might be something like 90,000. David Cameron isn't under pressure right now because of the EU referendum, so he's lucky. He's able to say, don't come anywhere near me. We'll vote out if you approach me with such requests. But if it seems if the rest of Europe is breaking up under the strain of Schengen, under the inability to resolve this question, then it might look as if Britain may as well vote out because Europe's cracking up anyway.
James, wouldn't it be quite tempting for a Eurosceptic to argue that voting out could bring about the collapse of the European Union, and this is a great thing because they've hated it all along and this is what they've always hoped for?
No, I mean, the argument that we should stay in the EU because it's about to collapse anyway is not a particularly strong one. It's like if someone said to you, oh, just stay in this building because it's about to fall down around your ears, you probably wouldn't think, oh, I'll wait around until it's actually fallen around, down. I think there is another thing, though, here, which is that we're very lucky in Britain because the crisis in Europe is far more profound than the crisis here because we have had sensible policies on both single currency and on the refugee crisis. We're actually insulated from the 2 worst things hitting Europe simultaneously. The 2 crises are making each other much worse. You know, the fact that you have almost 50% youth unemployment in some of these countries makes the idea of accepting refugees that much more politically difficult. And I think one of the things that is actually will have a massive influence on this referendum, is that when we joined the European Union, we were the sick man of Europe. We were the country that couldn't get anything right. We were the gang that couldn't shoot straight. We are now actually the country in Europe that is doing the best. Mm-hmm. And the question then becomes, does Europe need us more than we need Europe? I think at the moment, the Remain campaign are doing a good job of persuading voters that the short-term costs of leaving are too high to do it. You know, the Mark Carney intervention yesterday, the interest rates would be higher and therefore mortgages if we left the EU, all that stuff. It's almost too much hassle to leave the European Union. But fundamentally, I think for the first time in any of our lifetimes, if Britain left Europe now, the rest of the world would see it as saying more about the European Union than about Britain.
Fraser, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, as James says, the EU could do with this blast of confidence right now. I mean, as James quotes in this piece, I mean, Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the Commission, is talking about the EU disintegrating because Schengen is disintegrating. And it's funny that Europe is different things to different people. To us, it's a free trade deal. But there are many people in Europe to whom Europe is the EU is the ability to travel everywhere without borders. And if that is disintegrating, then some would argue in the continent that the EU is too. So if Britain says, yes, we had a very big discussion and we're going to stay in, it would give probably the first piece of good news the EU project has had for quite some time. But the polls are still very close. I mean, right now, the debate in Westminster has been almost uniformly behind the case for staying in. All of the cabinet members and ministers you thought might be declaring for out look like they're going to stay in. Right now, it looks like only Ian Duggan-Smith, Priti Patel, Theresa Villiers, Chris Grayling, people who you would anyway expect to be for out, with perhaps the exception of Priti Patel. There is no great movement towards it. So you're seeing a slight disconnect, I think, between the Westminster debate, which is 95% for in, and the national debate, which is far more evenly balanced. I still think this referendum could go either way, though in has the advantage right now.
And James, even though we haven't heard that many ministers coming out for out, we also haven't heard that many ministers defending David Cameron's renegotiation. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, that is accurate. I was very struck standing outside this time last week, the initial parliamentary meeting of the Conservatives for Reform in Europe, the David Cameron approved kind of Eurosceptics for Europe group that's been set up by Nick Herbert. I was amazed by how few people were there. When considering that Gavin Williamson, the Prime Minister's PPS, was there with a kind of clear indication that if you sign up to this group, your chances are probably quite good in the next reshuffle. The fact that it couldn't get more than 20 MPs was, I think, quite telling. And I mean, there is a problem here, which is if you have defined yourself politically as a Eurosceptic, it is quite hard to make the Eurosceptic case for staying in the European Union. And especially given events in Europe. Angela Merkel's coalition in Germany is now on the verge of collapse because the Bavarian sister party is saying, your refugee policy is, I'm going to take you to the High Court of Germany to challenge it. You look at what is happening in the rest of Europe, and weirdly enough, our referendum always seems like small beans in comparison to the challenges to the European project that are going on the continent. And I think that actually the best argument for out is that, do we want to have maximum leverage in these discussions about the change in Europe? You know, one of the great failures of this renegotiation is that Cameron has never taken the fact of how close Europe actually is to collapse to say, right, these are the following things that we want, because you know what the consequences of us leaving are.
I mean, it's funny that we're hearing now about how a real opportunity for renegotiation isn't now, but in 2019, after the French and German elections, they're going to have to do some deal where they merge their tax and economic systems more that would require treaty change and give us a veto. So you get this Eurosceptic case saying, look, let's stay in Europe now and let's really negotiate in 3 years' time because that's our greater moment of doing it. But it's interesting that the group that James refers to, the Eurosceptics for Europe, but I think one of the reasons that we don't hear much from them is because it's very difficult to make that case with much enthusiasm. That category, and I think it would include a great many Conservatives, would be people thinking, well, this is probably the least bad option. I don't like them. In fact, I loathe them. But staying with the devil we know is probably a little bit better than the risks of trying to renegotiate completely. So this is, I think, this category, the devil we know category, will be the ones that win it if it's going to be won. But none of them are going to vote or campaign or give speeches with much enthusiasm.
I was talking to a very pro-European Labour figure who said to me, imagine if a Scottish referendum, if the in case had been, everyone in Westminster is a charlatan. They're an awful, distant, out-of-touch elite. We've got no emotional attachment to this project, but we should probably stay in because that's ultimately what the banks and the financial services industry want. What would the result in Scotland have been? I don't think that case is quite right, but I think it's very hard to win a referendum without any kind of emotional argument.
That was this week's edition of The View from 22. Thank you for listening. To listen to more of our podcasts, visit our website at www.spectator.co.uk/podcast. Alternatively, to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, you can search under Podcasts for The Spectator. And podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22. Thank you.
Gary, Winston Wolf, Direct Line. Your landlord Mike says you wrecked his place.
Wait,
knocking holes in the walls. And all that graffiti? Fancy yourself an artiste?
No.
But it's all covered, Gary. Mike is with Direct Line. They'll cover up to the full amount insured for malicious damage by tenants.
Oh, good. Can I go now?
Oh, no, Gary. Direct Line's looking after Mike, but who's looking after you?
Direct Line Landlord Insurance covers up to the sum insured for malicious damage by tenants. Can your landlord insurance do that? Search Direct Line Landlord. Optional extra qualifying criteria and excess apply. Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.